Blog Talk Radio.
While we're sent home in our places, stuffing goodies in our faces, bitching about the television news and the price of gasoline. There's a man who was your neighbor somewhere in Southeast Asia, living in a bamboo cage and wondering what happened to the USA. He's a citizen of the free world. He's an American mother's son. He's a living contradiction. He's a shame to everyone. He ain't got no constitution, and his Bill of Rights are gone. The war's been
welcome to the inaugural show of Handling the Truth. You're listening to your co-host tonight, the Rebel Madman. Mike Gaddy is on with me. This is Terry Dodd. I am also known as Tenacity. And we're really looking forward to launching out this new series that we're going to be doing here at Handling the Truth. Well, hello, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, doing super, Terry. I hope you are.
I'm doing great. Hey, did you like that opening tune we played there?
Well, I tell you what, that brings back a lot of memories from about 30-plus years ago, my friend.
Well, this is the first time we've been back on Dr. Kate's Revolution Radio since Red Beckman passed away a little over a year ago, and certainly want to be mindful of Red and I feel like we're honoring him by continuing his tradition, and I know that's important to you too.
Oh, very much so. As you and I have talked about in the past, I think we have to carry on what our good friend and mentor Red did for us.
Amen to that. Well, one of the things he always wanted us to do was to open the show with a prayer. So I'm gonna open this one with a prayer, if that's okay.
Let's do it.
Almighty Father, we're just thankful for all the ways that you bless us, and we know that you're in control. We know that you created this whole universe, and your science is perfect. You know it. And we know that anything we try to do, that if we're not mindful of you and include your spirit in what we do, that we'll be just beating our heads against the wall. And we pray for you to watch over this show. We pray that everything we do and say here is pleasing to you and in your desire. So we ask you to bless us and bless this show, bless our listeners, and give them listening ears that can hear. And we're just so thankful for your son, our Savior, Yahshua. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, you wanted to start out with a subject called Swindled from the Beginning. You want to get us started on this history lesson?
Well, for sure. I would like to give a little bit of background, if I may, first. And that being that I had in my other life, I had some time with the oxymoronic field of government intelligence. And during that time, I began to see some things that was very troubling to me in a lot of different ways. Being brought up a good old Southern redneck boy, I just saw some things that in my world, as I grew up, just wasn't right. And then after that, I started working with a group in Washington, D.C. that was called the American Foundation for the Accountability of Prisoners of War and Missing in Action. And this was in the mid-80s, and the POW/MIA issue as it related to Vietnam was a big issue at that time. It was talked about quite a bit, a big movement, large movement towards, you know, as they said, we need to account for these people. You account for, you know, certain things. You don't account for human beings. That always troubled me, that phrase. But anyway, and I got into that. And during that time frame, I was also doing an awful lot of, and towards the end of my other career, I was doing an awful lot of research in the National Archives and in the Library of Congress, and even into several universities, into their archives, University of Maryland, University of Virginia, University of South Carolina, doing a lot of research. And I began to find a lot of things, Terry, that just didn't add up to me, not anything that I'd ever heard in a classroom before. As a matter of fact, it was I was looking at source documents or copies of source documents that – and back then it was on microfiche, if for those of us who are old enough to remember that. But I remember going through those microfiche files and finding documents from letters from our founders and letters back and forth between them. And I began to read things, and I went, you know, this is just contrary to everything I was ever taught in school. And I don't understand why I was taught one thing and these actual letters are telling me something contrary to that. And I even went to the curator in a couple of places, and I said, are these documents accurate? They are. They certainly are. So, pardon me. So I started thinking, well, you know, one of two things is true here. Either I was taught a bunch of lies in the public school system, as I call it now, and even into advanced education, even on the college level. I said, I've been taught a bunch of lies. And if that is true, I want to know why I was taught a bunch of lies. Well, you know, you coordinate this at the same time that I'm working with families, pardon me, families from who had people who were prisoners of war or missing in action enlisted after the Vietnam War. And then I got to meeting and talking with a lot of returned POWs themselves, many of whom are now deceased. And I spent a lot of hours with those men, and they were telling me, and I was learning about the great deception of this government, our government, not somebody else's government, ours. And then as I dealt and started looking into the records for POWs, I went all the way back to World War I, and I found out where this country had basically left fighting men in the hands of our enemy and then told the American people lies to cover it up. And that troubled me a great deal. And then when I started working with some of the POW families from the Vietnam era, and I started finding similar cases, things that were just absolutely where we had lied to families. And that really troubled me, because of the last people on earth that you would think the government would lie to would be to the families of those who put their lives on the line to allegedly defend this country. And why would you lie to their families? And to me, that was the ultimate form of treason, to lie to those families. And so I began to look into these records and what have you. And then I think the thing that I began to understand a lot then, Terry, was human nature. Because when I would take a lot of these actual copies of these fact who had been taught, just like I had, a pastel of lies in the public school system, they didn't want to believe it. And they said, no, there's got to be something wrong. No, I know I wasn't taught a lie. No, I can't believe that. There's something wrong. And then I found out, you know, you would even lose friends over this, or people you thought were your friends. They didn't want to talk to you anymore because suddenly you were saying things that made them uncomfortable. And I began to understand and got into some people that I worked with, and we talked about this situation. And I learned that people basically, as Emma Goldman said many years ago, Americans would rather know a comfortable lie than an uncomfortable truth. And then I found over the years is how that has really bothered us in this system, and how we believe that as a people, I'm not saying individually, but as a people, we believe that every 2 to 4 years we can go to the polls and we can cast a vote, and that's the only thing we have to do. And that because we're casting a vote and allegedly live in a free country, everything's going to work out in the end. And nothing could be farther from the truth, as we're beginning to stare right in the face of a national calamity right now. And so most of this goes to trust. But I guess the thing that probably upset me more than anything else, Terry, was this Constitution that I had sworn an oath to uphold and defend. And I got to looking at it, and then I realized that in many ways, as Samuel Bryan wrote, that the Constitution of the United States, the one we look at now, the one we revere, was actually formed with a criminal conspiracy. Now, I know everybody just lost their lunch over that one, but that is, in fact, true. And over a period of time, I think that it will not be hard to show people, if they're willing to accept the truth, that it's there. And for the listeners, if you don't have the courage to accept truth when it's actually presented to you, then you probably need to, turn on the cartoons or America's Most Wanted or something, because this just isn't going to be your cup of tea and you're not going to like it. So with that being said, how would you like to proceed from there, Terry?
Well, I think we just need to launch on into this, and we can talk about a lot of parts of it. People are now finding out today that even the video games are now being used, the online video games are now being used as a secure communication for the bad players, the evil players. They've actually determined that the Star Wars game, and I mean, so, you know, you talk about turning on cartoons. People are beginning to wake up, Mike. I mean, I don't think this is going to shock people all that much, because they're now realizing just how much they're being lied to. They realize that they can't turn on the television set without being lied to. I was in Denver proper today, and people were not wearing masks. And I was asking people if they wanted me to wear a mask when I was going in places, and they're like, oh, heck no. You know, they know now that they have a little bit better perspective, because these guys have overplayed their hand. So, you know, I think what you're going to share with them today is not going to be that big of a surprise.
Well, I would hope so, Terry. I hope that people are willing to accept the truth. And one of the things with me was, as I grew older and I kept seeing this government get more and more and more corrupt, and I began to notice that when I was voting, that I was voting against somebody. I wasn't voting for somebody. I was usually voting against somebody. And that troubled me I have to vote to keep somebody out of this government. Well, if this government operated the way the Constitution said it was going to work, I wouldn't have to worry about that, because the bad guys would be eliminated to start with. Some point in time, I read Lysander Spooner, and I read what he said, and he said that this government has either allowed the corruption that we see today, or it was powerless to prevent it. And so, having been in the intelligence field, one of the first things you do is when you find a source of intel, your number one job or your number one task is to prove it wrong. And if you can't prove it wrong, then you have to accept the fact that it could be true. And I looked at Lysander Spooner, and he said, well, this government it was designed to allow this to happen. So that made me go even deeper into the subject and look into it. And then the more I looked into it, the more I found that there was a fraud that happened with the Constitution. And this is the thing I ask people over and over again. Would you trust a group of politicians and lawyers who got together, who was going to decide what kind of government you were going to live under, and they did all of their proceedings in secret and swore an oath not to reveal what they had done for 50 years. See, that was the first thing that began to trouble my mind, is that if you have made something so good and you have created this Constitution that many people say was inspired by God, if you've done this, then why are you trying to hide that you did it for 50 years? It would appear to me that you'd be proud of it, and you'd say, hey, look at this. Here's what we did. This is how we did it. This is how. But they didn't want anybody to know that. They even put guards in front of the doors to keep people from coming in to find out or listening in to see what they were saying, and they had the meeting on the second floor. Then when
well,
I got
I'm
into
trust
it,
that you're go-,
I, go ahead.
I trust you're going to take a step back and talk a little bit about the Articles of Freedom and what they were actually commissioned to do at the Philadelphia Convention in 1787. Are you going to give a little background on that?
Yes, that was that I'm going to be working in that direction. And that was part of after we found out that they were meeting in secret, let's back up, and we have to go back several years to understand why this was happening. Because we know we had a constitution, and people want to call it by different words, I'm not sure why, but we had a form of government that had been ratified in 1781. It was called the Art of Federation and Perpetual Union. Most people today want to leave that Perpetual Union off because it illustrates part of the fraud. So all of the states had ratified this in 1781, by 1781, Maryland being the last. And so we had a system of government that we were operating under. The problem is that the people who were considered the rich and well-born in that era, and we have them in every era, and somehow they automatically gravitate towards government and politics. You know, look at how many billionaires we have in politics today. But anyway, this was they wanted to use government to promote their self-interest. Trying to use the Articles of Confederation, and they kept coming up short because under Article 13, all of the 13 states had to agree to any form of legislation. Anything that was passed, all 13 states had to agree to it. Well, if we go back to the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence tells us that a government operates under the consent of the governed. It doesn't say under the consent of the majority of the governed. It doesn't say under the consent of a supermajority of the governed. It says under the consent of the governed, which would mean all of them. So they had divided up the states, and any state could veto any piece of legislation. Well, I gave a program one time in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and this guy got very upset, and he said, well, we couldn't live under a system like that because we'd never get any laws passed. And I thought, then that's a bad thing, how? And I know we have to have certain laws. Any society has to have certain laws. But how many of the laws that have been passed can we say are really good? Most of the things that have been passed we have tried to fight against being passed. We fight against what the government is doing and not for it. Because, you know, take any of your amendments and see how they've been trashed, your 10 amendments, and see how they've been trashed. So the Articles of Confederation were there. They were very restrictive. And if you look carefully at the Articles of Confederation, it has almost everything that the people are screaming for today in government. They had what was called rotation, which we call term limits. And everybody's saying, well, we ought to have term limits. So these people ought to be term limited. Well, we had them, but the rich and well-born in the society in 1787 did not want term limits. As a matter of fact, when they went to the Constitution, they actually wanted people to serve for life, including the president and the governors. Thank goodness we had some people there who fought against that and were able to weaken it down some, but that is exactly what they wanted. They actually wanted another monarchy. They just wanted to run it. They didn't mind the monarchy of King George. They just wanted to run the government. And so they were willing to, and they started saying, oh, well, the Constitution is failing. The Articles of Confederation are failing. You know, commerce, commerce, commerce. It's all about commerce. And now we've gotten people in America to believe that the Articles of Confederation were bad because of commerce. But who went to Philadelphia in 1787 to fix this government but the ones who were involved in commerce and lawyers? Of the 55 attendees at the Constitutional Convention, 32 of them were lawyers. And so we had a group of people creating a government, and they wanted to get away from the other government of the Articles of Confederation because they're just too restrictive. Also, imagine this, Terry. Under the Articles of Confederation, they had immediate recall. If you elected someone and sent them to Congress and they got up there and they started doing things that you hadn't agreed to when you voted for them, you had your state legislature could do an immediate recall. Hey, come back here. You're not doing what you were said to do. Can you imagine a politician be willing to put up with that today? So you had.
Well, there was one. You remember the GO movement, the Get Out of Our House guys?
Right.
They suggested that anyone in order to run as a candidate should sign a contract, which says they will resign if they break their contract.
Right. And we had that. We basically had that right there in position in the Articles of Confederation. And they just could not allow this to happen. You had what they call rotation, which meant that no one could serve in government more than 3 years out of any six. And that's in the Articles of Confederation. So people now need to understand that the commerce that the people we call the founders, the commerce that they wanted was the commerce that would benefit them. And they weren't able to achieve that form of government that would benefit them in their particular enterprises. They couldn't do it with the Articles of Confederation because all it took was one state to say no. And they had to escape that. They had to get away from that. Every state that went to the Constitutional Convention, and see, number one is they were still operating under the Articles of Confederation until June of 1788, until the ninth state ratified the Constitution. So technically they were still under the authority and under the powers of the Articles of Confederation. And they were sent to, with the exception of New Jersey did not stipulate this. The other states were sent to Philadelphia, their delegates were sent to Philadelphia to amend the Articles of Confederation. And yes, they needed some amendment.
What was the criteria for ratification under the Articles of Confederation? In other words, to amend the Articles of Confederation, what was the criteria for ratification of that amendment?
Every state had to agree.
You just said that only nine states ratified and that brought in the new Constitution.
Right. And so that was a violation of the Constitution they were operating under. And if you look at the history and look at the letters between James Madison, George Washington, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, when you look at the letters between them and Edmund Randolph, when you look at those letters, prior to the convention itself, it was absolutely clear that the delegates who were going to that convention had no intention whatsoever of following the directions they were given from their individual states. They had no intention of doing it. They said in advance that they had to get rid of the state's power. James Madison said he didn't want any state to have any power that would make them anything more than subordinately useful to the central government. It's in the letters. You can read it. George Washington wrote to John Jay and said Go ahead.
I'm sorry. There's been some people who have who have been trying to say that you can set rules of a constitutional convention prior to the convention. Yet here we've got a group who closed the doors, pulled the blinds, elected their officers of the convention, and then set the rules. Would it be any different today?
Well, I don't see how it could be, Terry, because it's a plebiscite. And any plebiscite, by nature, they set their own rules when they start the meeting, and that's exactly what happened in Philadelphia. They set the rules of the meeting, and those rules contain the 50-year secrecy clause. And Luther Martin of Maryland started complaining, and he said, wait, we can't do that. I've got constituents back in Maryland that I want to talk about these things before I vote for them because I represent them. I'm not here on my own. I represent my people back in Maryland, and if we're going to talk about things and I can't ask my people if it's okay with them, then there's something wrong with this convention. But he was voted down, and they said, no, we don't talk to anybody outside of these walls. People don't know what we're doing, and we have
Was it at this point that some people left?
Well, we had people leave at different times. The thing of it was is we know three who left. We know that Luther Martin, the man I just spoke of, who was the attorney general for the state of Maryland, he left, but he left in late August when the convention was almost over, and he didn't come back, and he didn't sign the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton left the convention five times. We had two delegates who left the convention, and they were both from New York, and they were both judges, and at one time or another, both of them were Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of New York. And their names were Robert Yates and John Lansing, Jr. Well, on July the 10th, they said, no, we can't do this anymore. We're going home, and we can't do this because, and they wrote a letter to the governor of, governor of New York, I'm sorry, him a letter, and they detailed why they left. And it's a very beautiful letter. I would recommend everyone to read it. I'm not going to try to read it to the people. It's a little long, but I'll break it down. And basically they said, as fine as the delegates are here and nice people and everything else, they are violating and we are violating the authority that was given to us by the people of the state of New York. And we're violating their confidence, and we can't stay here. We can't continue this. And they said instead of making a confederated government with all of the parts, they're making one huge centralized government that will be ruled from the top, and the states will have no authority whatsoever. And so those two left, and they didn't return. And there have been historians who said, well, they should have stayed. And we also have to think about what is, to me, my hero of the American founding, and that's Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry, when he was invited to attend the Constitutional Convention, and they felt like they had to, the people of Virginia, because of all of the things that Patrick Henry had done, you know, his famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech, and he started the huge fight against the Stamp Act in 1765. He went against the powers of the he was accused of, they started yelling treason at him when he said that we should take up arms against the king if he's going to tax us like this. But Patrick Henry, when he was invited, said, no, I smell a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia, and he didn't go. So one of the points, and I asked this question today in a public forum, is why would we believe James Madison, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and George Washington, and not believe Patrick Henry, Samuel Bryan, Robert Yates, and Mercy Otis Warren, the woman who was very much involved in this, who gets no attention in history whatsoever. So I shouldn't say whatsoever. She gets some, but not what she deserves. And so why are we told that we believe the people who supported a strong central government, which is basically a monarchy any way you look at it, and then we talk about, no, we can't support these other folks because they predicted exactly what we're dealing with today. People became known as the anti-federalists because Alexander Hamilton and imagine politicians coming up with sneaky names that are the exactly opposite of what they represent. Let's try Patriot Act, Affordable Health Care Act, try some of those acts, and then think that they call them, and Alexander Hamilton said, we'll call ourselves the Federalists. Well, they didn't stand for a federal form of government. They stood for a nationalist or a monarchist form of government. As a matter of fact, on June the 18th of 1787, Alexander Hamilton proposed a monarchy. He proposed a governor-king, as he called it, who would rule for their entire lifetime, and they would appoint every governor of every state for a lifetime. The only thing the people would be able to do was to vote for the lower house, which today would be the House of Representatives, but the king or governor could overrule the legislature at time he wanted to. And that is the government that Alexander Hamilton proposed. It's right there in writing. And you know what? When I went to school, I was never taught that.
Didn't they actually vote something in before some of the delegates from the latter that showed up late? Didn't they vote something in that the delegates that came in refused to go along with and made them change things?
Yes, that is true. And we also had, let's get back to the part that Rhode Island chose not to send anybody. So Rhode Island sends no one, so that immediately made the convention illegal because they were still operating under the Articles of Confederation, which required all 13 states to agree. So if Rhode Island said it's such a farce, we won't even send anybody, then that should have negated the convention from the very beginning. And then when two delegates out of three, which is a quorum, left for New York, New York no longer had a vote. The delegation from New Hampshire didn't get there until late June, so they missed the early part, May and June, later May and early June and mid-June. They missed all of that. So of the delegates, and then you have, when you finish the whole thing, and I'm not jumping too far ahead, but when they finished the, they had three delegates that refused to sign. Now, how many times are we told about that? You had three delegates who refused to sign. George Mason, who had written the Virginia Bill of Rights even before we had a Declaration of Independence, and George Mason said, I would rather chop off my right hand than affix my signature to this document. If someone felt so strong about the Constitution not being what they said it was, why does that not trouble people? And why is he disregarded?
I don't know. I've heard about Mason's objections before, but I know that it's not something you get taught in school.
No, I mean, I found out Mason's objections years later, and it wasn't brought up in school, and I'm not blaming a lot of my teachers because I know that the socialist system took over the public education system in the United States over almost 100 years ago. So I'm not upset at my teachers. They taught what they were taught, and they believed what they were taught just as the rest of us did. But we were not taught the truth, and I think we have to wonder why we were not taught the truth. And there's so much of our history that is just what we're taught is a blatant lie. Trouble me. I know other people go, well, you know, it's what we got. It's what we got to live with, blah, 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 blah. You know, and we have three amendments to our Constitution that's never been ratified, but the Supreme Court doesn't know that, or at least they won't mention it. There were so many things, Terry, I think we could go into a lot of detail about things, you know, you and I have talked about them before. We could go into a lot of detail about things that happened at the Constitutional Convention that were just wrong, but we're never taught about that. You know, we aren't taught about the fact that there was, you know, this is one of the things that troubled me, and I was talking about it earlier today with on another talk radio show. And that was the fact that if you search history books and you look through books on the Constitution, you look through all the authors who've written all the Constitution, and there's a bunch of them, and you read their stuff, and then you find out, you learn as you really delve into this Constitution, that they don't write anything about Article 6, Section 3, or Article 6, Clause 3. It's left out. And you don't know the history of that. And so you have to ask yourself, why wasn't I taught the history of Article 6, Clause 3? The reason being is because that prior to the Constitutional Convention, 1787, 12 of the 13 states, the only one not having an oath to the Christian faith in their Constitution to serve in any office, the only state that didn't have that for their state people, whether they be elected or appointed, the only state that didn't have that was Rhode Island. So 13 states had an oath that had to be taken. I can read those at some point in time in our programs, Terry, and I think that would be a good idea to actually read the oath that the people took back then. And it was an oath to the Christian faith. Well, the founders decided they couldn't have that. Now, not only did they eliminate the oath to the Christian faith in the U.S. Constitution, they eliminated the oath to the Christian faith in the state constitutions. So they were eliminating any oath to the Christian faith, and you have to ask yourself, why? Why would they not want to do that? And then in the program today, I was talking about, ironically, not too long ago, someone sent me a list of all of the Muslims who are running for office in the United States this year, even down to the local level. And if you haven't seen that list, I would suggest everyone needs to look at that. And it made me remember that there was a delegate from the state of South Carolina in the middle of their ratification convention who spoke out against Article 6, Section 3. And he said, if we eliminate the Christian faith, if we take that out of everything, eventually this country, we will have the non-believers and Muslims in our government. Well, imagine that. And how could someone have predicted that 230 years ago?
Well, I've heard you say several times, even in the last couple of months, that the anti-federalists must have been prophets because they seem to be able to predict exactly what we've seen happen since then, in 200 years in advance.
Well, you know, and that is something I think, you know, that we probably ought to look at, Terry, and I'm trying to find it right now and it's into my head. So if you will kind of lead us on, talk about what we're talking about, and let me find this document here. It should take me about 2 minutes or more.
Well, okay. You know, the word swindled is a pretty strong word. That's a serious accusation that we're leveling at what these guys did, and we're going to get into some of the details, I'm sure, with Mike regarding, you know, the conspiracy that went on. We've called this convention of Philadelphia of 1787, where this Constitution was created, we have stated, Mike just said, that it's a criminal conspiracy that went on. And you don't make those kind of accusations just out of opinion. You know, we're going to back this up with some actual events and letters and correspondence, and we're going to take a look at who the players were who actually conspired with one another to bring about a constitution that allowed for the corruption and the changes that have happened over the last couple hundred years. And we're going to see that it's not by accident that these have happened, and it's not new thoughts that have brought these corruption into play. It was actually a matter of conspiracy. And some of what we've been witnessing, we're also going to see that right after this Constitution was ratified, the creation of bureaucracies that were really outside of the delineated powers of the Constitution started right away. Obama put like 120 new bureaucracies into existence while he was in office. That, to me, is criminal in and of itself, because, I mean, talk about being outside of the boundaries of this Constitution. But we're going to see that there were limits there, that certain players caused those limits to be removed. And I know Mike's going to get into that. But I just wanted to kind of give you a little bit of perspective of where we're going with this. This is not just a matter of opinion to say, okay, look at where we are today, and this must have happened back then. We've got this more than the smoking gun to show that, in fact, there was a conspiracy to create a constitution that would allow this kind of centralized power amongst the elite. You ready, Mike?
Yes, sir, I am. And I mentioned before the two gentlemen that left the Constitutional Convention on July the 10th. And one of them was Robert Yates, who became the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court. And he was sitting on the court, not as Chief Justice, but he was sitting on the court when he attended the Constitutional Convention. And he wrote, as an anti-federalist, he opposed opposed the ratification of the Constitution, made some very elaborate speeches at the New York Ratification Convention, and also wrote under the pen name of Brutus as an anti-federalist. And stop and think about today, in today's world, and look what this man predicted 230-some years ago. And I quote, "I said in my last number that the Supreme Court under this Constitution would be exalted above all other power in the government and subject to no control. The business of this paper will be to illustrate this and to show the danger that will result from it. Question whether the world ever saw in any period of it a court of justice invested with such immense powers and yet placed in a situation so little responsible. Certain it is that in England and the other several states where we have been taught to believe the courts of law are put upon the most prudent establishment, they are on a different footing with this Constitution." He also said that men placed in this position, and of course women, we have women there now, placed in this position would eventually begin to believe that their power was not even limited by heaven. And stop and think today, when the Supreme Court of the United States issues an opinion, let's talk about Roe v. Wade, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act, let's talk about their decisions become immediately law, but it becomes the perceived law. After the decision on Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, were people able to say, no, I'm not going to do that? Were the states able to say, no, I'm not going to do that? After the Patriot Act, were people arrested for violating provisions of the Patriot Act? After the Supreme Court, backed it up, and after they backed up Roe v. Wade, how many abortions have we had in this country? People, you don't understand that the powers that was given to this court that no court should ever have. And even the powers that were given to the Supreme Court of the United States were more powerful than the Supreme Court of England at the time we fought a war to separate ourselves from them. So this Constitution gave more power to the Supreme Court than England had in there. People who say, no, we don't have a monarchy, don't forget what Benjamin Franklin said. He said, we have a republic if you can keep it. Well, guess what? When he said that, what was the Constitution. The Constitution was the Articles of Confederation, and the, what he
well,
had
how,
just helped configure.
How is the court as it is set up now different than the way it was under the Articles of Confederation?
Well, you didn't have a Supreme Court under the Articles of Confederation. You didn't have a judicial branch under the Articles of Confederation. They felt like the states dealt with their own problems. And each state, that's why you have a confederation of states. Those states had their own courts, and their court systems would decide. And the Supreme Court of the United States, put in as the central government, basically immediately gave an override to any state decision that was done by a state court that the central government didn't agree with. So it was set up from the beginning that no state was going to be able to overrule the central government. In other words, no state was going to be able to decide for the people who live within that state. Whatever that state decided had to be agreed to, basically, in theory, by the rest of the states. So the independence was gone. And it was destroyed with that. And since I'm thinking it's over 1,300 state laws that the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down in its history. And here's the question I ask people, and they look at you, especially when you ask lawyers and judges this question, you really get the deer in the headlights look. If the Supreme Court made a decision and said something was constitutional, how can they reverse that decision? Because to reverse that decision is to say their first decision was not constitutional, but their second one is. So what happens to all the people who paid penalties under that one that they said was constitutional and then decided they didn't? And I think a classic example of this is the Sanford v. Dred Scott Supreme Court decision 1957, which took a free black man in a free state and took his freedom away and took him back and put him back in slavery. That's the bottom line of what that court decision did. And that court decision 3 years later led to the South seceding because the Supreme Court had declared slavery to be legal. One person can own another one. And we all know how deplorable that is. So we've got time said, okay, it's all right to put a man into slavery, and it's okay for people to own slaves. And then, 100 years later or so, they say, okay, it's all right to kill an unborn child. And we're supposed to say that this government was designed to be ethical and moral. How? Wherein was that? Because if it was, why did we have slavery from the beginning? Why did we have slavery in the Constitution from the beginning? There were several states that the Constitutional Convention said, well, let's just split now. Let's split and let's let the South take their slaves. And I'm a Southerner. They said, let the South take their slaves and let them have their own country, and we'll have a country that doesn't have slaves. Who said no to that? The people who said no to that were the people up north because they were profiting from slavery. Remember what I said? We had the well-born and the merchants and what have you in the Constitutional Convention, and they said, well, where's all the money being made on slavery? It's being made out of Rhode Island and Massachusetts, and, oh, well, we can't cut our financial throat here just so we can free a black man. And Luther Martin fought very hard against even having slavery at all. He wanted it excluded. And, of course, he ended up leaving. So that is, I think just to get people to get their mind wrapped around this, where did the whole, if it was a good thing to start with, where did it go wrong? And as Patrick Henry said at the Virginia Ratification Convention, and he spoke on 17 of the 21 or 23 days, and he spoke every day against the Constitution, one day for 7 hours. he spoke against the Constitution. Now, people, he didn't have a speechwriter. He didn't have a teleprompter. And he had to speak, he spoke for 7 hours against the Constitution. And he said that we have no way to hold the people responsible. There's no provision in this Constitution which allows us to hold someone if we, this isn't what he said, I'm using today's terminology. If we elect someone, they take an oath, a sacred oath, to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the domestic enemy to the Constitution is the person who votes against it or tries to bring up a bill against it. They automatically become what we're supposed to protect the Constitution from. So if we had someone who did that, and they passed, they worked and did whatever they could to get something unconstitutional passed, why can't we stop that? Where is the provision to stop it? And we all know, we say, okay, well, we have a right to petition for a redress of grievances. Yes, you do. The Supreme Court has said you can petition all you want to. We don't have to answer. The Constitution says you can petition, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to answer your petition. So if it's, you know, I would love to go back to, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th grade when I thought the Constitution was fantastic and it was divinely inspired. I wish it was. I wish it was what we are taught that it is, but it's not that. And if it is what we've been taught that it is, why are we in this mess right now? Why are we got so many corrupt people in our government? And, you know, as I said before, look at the people who want to run the government, multimillionaires and billionaires. They want to be in charge of the government. They don't want to be in charge of the government to help me and you. They don't care about me and you. They want to be in charge of the government to help themselves and their business cronies. And that's the way it was in 1787, and they set up the policy to do that. Thoughts, Terry?
Well, I'm just coming back to the statement that it was a criminal conspiracy. You obviously turned up some things that brought you to that decision, and I think we need to really focus on that a little bit.
Well, when I first heard it, and when I first read it, and I read it in one of Samuel Bryan, who wrote his Sentinel, I read it in his essays, and he called it a criminal conspiracy, and by that time I had read enough documents and stuff that I knew that it was a conspiracy. Because, you know, you had Washington you had Washington, Madison, and John Jay and Alexander Hamilton writing letters about what we're going to do when we get to Philadelphia. That creates a conspiracy. Technically, that's a conspiracy. And we had a law at that time that they were supposed to be going by, which was called the Articles of Confederation. So if you have a law that you are conspiring to break, you are a criminal. So therefore, and we've got, you know, somebody told me one time that if we let all of the people out of prison who were there for conspiring to commit a crime, it would be somewhere between 20 and 30% of the people in the federal penitentiary. So conspiring to commit a crime is, or to break the law is a crime. We have people in prison for it. So the people who planned to create an entirely new form of government before they got to Philadelphia, and they, you can read it in the letters, they're talking about it. We have a right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience. It's a letter from General Washington to, from George Washington to John Jay. He was no longer a general, I'm sorry. So there's the letter. We have the right to do this. And he said in the same letter to John Jay, these people don't know what's best for them, and so it has to be left to some. He doesn't say who the other people are. People are not capable of making decisions in their best interest. Does that sound like any politician you've heard lately? You really don't understand everything, or you understand that?
Yeah, there are several people who have made statements similar to that. Obviously, George Soros believes that, but also Rockefeller, before he passed, made similar comments to that.
Well, Henry Kissinger's made a bunch of them over the years.
Right.
We can go back to the 70s, right. And he's made, I don't know how many. He, you know, he called the military dumb, stupid animals fit only for foreign policy. You know, and people still say, oh, well, Henry Kissinger must be a good guy. We have the people who say this, and to stay comfortable, to stay in our comfortable zones, we dismiss that. He's a nut. I'm not going to worry about that. Well, he's got power, so he's not a nut. For a moment, who George W. Bush wanted to put in as the chief investigator for the 9/11 deal before it, and that was Henry Kissinger. And he got so much blowback over that that they changed. But that was his original pick, was Henry Kissinger. So we have no way, again, to go back to Patrick Henry. How are we to punish these people if they do not follow their oaths? Well, we have no way to punish them. The only way we have to punish them is called an election. You can punish them by taking them out of office. But if you put a senator in office for 6 years, how much damage can he or she do before you can vote them out? If you only got two presidents, you got four. But you're still putting people in there that can do whatever they want to for that period of time. You know, I think it was Tim Kaine, I think was his name, that ran as the vice president under Hillary. His voting record with the Constitution out of the state of Virginia was less than 1% of the time. And if you look at these statistics about how people vote with the Constitution, yes, I said the Constitution is lacking. But I will stipulate this, that if we adhered to the Constitution as ratified, we would have a much better country. It would not be perfect, but we would have the Constitution as ratified. And both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison said, if you want to know what the Constitution means, if you want to know what it was intended, then go back to the ratification conventions, find out what the people were promised and what they agreed to. And if you really go ahead.
I find it interesting that some very bright and well-intended people look to the Federalist Papers to determine what original intent was.
Yeah, that's one of the things I think people have to understand is that there was a anti-Federalist by the name of Cato. And that was most probably Governor George Clinton of New York. So within just a few days after the Constitution was released to the public, and it had some people had time to read it. None of the people who lived in rural America had a chance to read it at that time. But the people who had a chance to read it, Governor Clinton writes under the name Cato, and he comes out with a broadside against the Constitution, all the things that was wrong with it. You can find that in Cato number one. So immediately, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison, who is from Virginia, they go to New York and they set about writing papers to oppose these objections to the Constitution. And so that's where they came from. That was the idea. We have to, and then Alexander Hamilton went after Robert Yates, and he was writing about what the Constitution would become. I read for that for you earlier in Federalist number 78. Alexander Hamilton says that the Supreme Court will be the weakest part of our government. So which one of those two guys were right? The first were an ad campaign. Probably the first big ad campaign in America, and they were read mostly in New York. They didn't get a lot out of New York City at all. Some of them did, but most of them didn't. Most of the times they didn't get, especially out to the to what we would call the common folks out in the countryside. So that, I guess, is to that point about the Federalist. And then for people who want to believe the Federalist, I would take you to Federalist 45, written by James Madison, and he says the powers of the central government will be few and well defined, and all of the other powers of government will rest with the states. That's what he said in Federalist 45. Is that true? Is that what we have today? See, that when you look at the Federalist Papers and you get to the ratification conventions, the Federalist Papers were what was promised to the people if they would ratify the Constitution. And what the Federalists wrote was what would happen if they did ratify the Constitution. And another thing, Terry, and I skipped this, and I apologize for that, but one of the things that people do not understand is the fact that the Constitution, as it left Philadelphia in September of 1787, had no Bill of Rights, had voted to not add a Bill of Rights to the Constitution. Why would you write a government in which to write up the form of government where the people had no rights? And you had the people like James Wilson who said, well, actually what it is the people have so many rights, we don't have room to write them all down. Okay, would you take that as a guarantee on the new car you just bought? There's so many things we guarantee on that car. There are so many, we just don't have enough paper to write it on. So you just go ahead and buy the car, and it will all be taken care of.
So that'd be pretty gullible.
Well, and that's what we did. That's what we accepted. And then people are not aware of the fact that the states, the reason that we had a Bill of Rights is because several states said we will not ratify the Constitution without it. And so they had to, so James Madison, especially in Virginia, when it got to the last part, he was so afraid that that Patrick Henry, with all of his passion and all of his strength, that he was going to convince enough people to not ratify it in Virginia. And since Virginia was the largest state in the Union as far as population and land area was concerned at that time, that if Virginia didn't ratify it, they knew they were in trouble, because Washington was from Virginia and they were going to make him president. They just, without the people from Virginia, the country was, they just did not feel like the country would take off. So Virginia had to be brought in. The last day that, well, not the last day, next to last day, when Patrick Henry spoke for 7 hours, Madison was running around to the delegates promising them that if they would vote to ratify, that he promised them a Bill of Rights. And that is why the Virginia delegation listed 20 things they wanted in the Bill of Rights with their ratification agreement. So a legal question I've had for legal people over and over, and they can't answer this one either, is that if Virginia was accepted in the Constitution or into the country with the Constitution, ratifying the Constitution, within their ratification agreement, if they list those 20 Bill of Rights, that constituted a contract, country not adopt all 20 of those Bill of Rights. You agreed to a contract when they ratified. Or the federal government could have said, nope, we can't let you in with all of those provisions. You can only have three or whatever. But they didn't say that. They said, okay, come on in, Virginia. Here, we'll take you. And so we've got, there we are. We've got Virginia in. Virginia stipulated, so stipulated. New York so stipulated that they had a Bill of Rights. And Rhode Island so stipulated. And ironically, listen to this. What else did those three states put into that, the ratification agreements? if at any time the federal government infringes upon the rights of the people of the state, we have a right to separate and to make the decision null and void, our contract null and void. Because if you break the contract, and that's the deal with the contract, if the federal government breaks the contract, the other offended party has the right to leave the contract. Of course, when that was tried in 1860-1861, Abraham Lincoln decided he'd kill about 750,000 people to make sure that didn't happen. So the provisions were there. And again, Terry, I take us back to one of my favorite Bible verses on this subject, and that is Hosea 4:6. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, and they have rejected knowledge. And when someone is willing to tell you, and when I start my classes, I tell people, I don't believe a word I say. Look it up. I'll tell you where to look. I tell the people the same thing who are listening tonight. Did you say we need to take a break, Terry?
No, I was just letting you know I've been sending you messages on the Skype so that you could see, and we've been on for a little over an hour. I know you were contemplating doing the first show for 1 hour. We did have someone that actually had a hand up, and they just called back in. That's on our switchboard listening on the phone, and they don't have their hand up now, but they did earlier, and I didn't know if you were wanting to take any questions or not.
Well, if you would like to do that, I mean, you're the one that's familiar with the format. If you would like to do that, I have no problem.
Okay. Let's give it a shot here and see who this is. Area code 605, you have a live mic. Would you tell us who you are?
My name's Joe. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Good, Joe. Did you have a question?
Actually, a comment. Your guest was talking about if we went back to the Constitution, it wouldn't be perfect, but it'd be a good start. The problem I have with the Constitution is Article 1, Section 8. I don't know if you had mentioned before, but there was another person in the anti-federalist. I think his name was Brutus or Bruto, or maybe he was even Cato. And he was disparaging the general welfare clause. And it seemed to me that he was pretty much on point. That general welfare clause gives Congress way, way too much power. So I would actually like to see the Constitution rewritten, but then, of course, that would require months, if not years, of debate and more debate. But I'm glad we have a republic as opposed to a democracy. But I wanted to put that in there. Also, you had mentioned people don't realize what's really going on today. People have it's a very devout, very strong aversion to change, especially if it concerns the government, which they've been brainwashed in believing that the government is their protector of all things. So they don't want to believe that the Congress is corrupt. They know that it's corrupt in terms of backdoor deals, maybe. But in terms of Congress being corrupt enough to sell America down the river for a few million dollars as though they were born communists, they want to resist that. I know, because I was there, and I had a predilection towards accepting that particular concept. So it's very hard. People know about Rothschild's conspiracy theories, corruption, etc. But to believe that even Pelosi, me, in my mind.
Joe.
Yes.
Joe. Let's let Mike address what you've talked about so far, okay?
Okay.
Well, I agree with you, Joe. Thanks for the comments. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is the one that gives the powers to Congress. And when we had all these wonderful people in Philadelphia in 1787, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, which was the very first power that these people put into the Constitution, gave the Congress the ability to tax us at any rate they want to, up including all of it. There are no limitations in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 that gives us any that gives the people any say so in how much they can be taxed. There's no limit. And as for the general welfare clause, that is something I plan to get into on another show and to go into several of those clauses, the general welfare clause, the commerce clause, and the necessary and proper clause, which our good friend Patrick Henry called the elastic clauses. And I plan to do that at sometime at one of our shows in the future, and I surely hope you'll tune in and listen.
And we certainly appreciate callers calling in. And the idea of allowing someone call in is to ask a question. We really don't want folks bloviating here, if you will, but we appreciate your comment, Joe. So, Mike, we're right now an hour and 10 minutes into the show. How much longer do you want to go for today?
Well, I've got as much of the stuff on the Constitution as you want to do. I hope I addressed Joe's questions and we could get into that. And the anti-federalist you were talking about was Brutus, and that was Robert Yates of New York that I mentioned before because he was so prescient on the Supreme Court. So we can rejoin this on our next program. Terry, jump off into your subject for the second hour.
Into my subject?
Yes. Our subject.
What did you want to talk about?
Let's address where we are today. Let's talk about, we've talked about a constitution that has been in effect for 230 years now, and let's talk about the situation that we're in today, and has the constitution protected us, or has the constitution being used by and for other people against us, has that brought us to the mess we're in right now?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand the accountability standard, or the standard of accountability that we have to hold our current politicians to, is this Constitution that was in fact ratified. Even though it was a criminal conspiracy, it is what we're dealing with today. So it's
correct.
It's important to understand that we need to defend this Constitution, in spite of the fact that it's it was a criminal conspiracy, and that they didn't do what they were sent there to do, and they kept it secret for at least 50 years, really all the way up until now, pretty much, because the way that they've educated people. But here we are, we find ourselves now in serious trouble because we are facing a global depression. And even though we in the United States are only beginning to feel just a tiny little bit of that, we're going to be taking a hit on this. Everybody's going to suffer as a result of what we're going through right now, and we have no way to enforce a redress of grievance, just like Mike, you said a while ago. And therein lies the problem. We've been petitioning the federal government on almost every violation that they've in ways that they violated the present Constitution. Almost every violation has been petitioned to the federal government, and they never respond. There's no way to hold them accountable, and that's a serious problem in this Constitution, and that's really what we're pointing out, is that they set it up that way. It's not some accident. I mean, they deliberately conspired to give us this document so that we could not hold them accountable. And here we are, and we really need to be able to be vocal local at this point, because that's the only way that we're going to put the government in a position where they become afraid that the people are literally going to rebel. I mean, if you've got a protest going on right now in your state, I know here in Colorado we've got one going on at noon tomorrow at the state capitol. I plan on being there tomorrow. But it's really critical for your state government, your county government, and even your local municipality to understand that the people are not going to continue to tolerate them crushing our economy, which is a greater threat to the loss of life than any virus could be. Is that what you were referring to, Mike?
Yes, and that, and as I said previously, the thing that I think that is so critical is that the Constitution we need to adhere to, and you are right, it is the accepted law, regardless of how we got it. It's regardless if the car was stolen, we're still riding in it. So the point is that we need to adhere to the Constitution as ratified, not the Constitution as interpreted by the government itself. Because if you take it back to the point it was ratified, it's where the people agreed. If you let them do it as it's interpreted, it's where the lawyers decide what the Constitution means, and they don't study the Constitution in law school. And I'm sure that probably surprises people, but they really don't. So to adhere to that as closely as possible, and that's why I said if we adhered to the Constitution as ratified, then we would have a much better country. Perfect? No. But we would have a much better country than what we have now, and we would have some way to hold people responsible. We have no way to hold anyone responsible right now. Just talking to a friend in New Mexico, and he said the governor of the state of New Mexico has ordered the cell phone companies to track people so that she can tell if they are violating their quarantine or their stay-at-home stuff. Now, will someone please point out to me in the Constitution where that governor has that power? And I'm talking about the state constitution as well. No one has that power. So they're doing it. So what is the recourse? The Constitution is not
well,
working.
Well, I just want to congratulate that one mayor down there. I think it's in Grant. Is it Grant, New Mexico, the town?
Grants, yes.
And he's basically opened the town back up and telling the governor to take a hike. And if she wants to try to send in the state police, he's already got his policemen advised on how to stop them from coming in. You know, he's taken a stand. He's drawn a line. And that's exactly what we need. We need our county commissioners and our town councils and basically really our county sheriffs is who really needs to step up at this point, because they're the highest law enforcement in any county in the United States other than Alaska, where they don't have them. But they have the power to tell the feds, you don't come into my county without my permission. So you can be vocal local, and you can get to your local people and have a greater impact than trying to do anything on a statewide or a federal level. I mean, so that's really what we need to be doing right now. We need to be saying we're not putting up with this. They need to hear loud and clear that we're not going to have any more extensions of this shutdown of businesses and economy. All right, enough on my soapbox. We got about 10 minutes left in this time allotted. So,
well,
how do you want to
Kerry,
close this out?
I agree very, very much with what you just said. But that vocal local stuff, I've been involved in that. I was involved in that in Colorado, and I saw that didn't work in many situations, because we were trying to push a constitutional sheriff, but they decided they'd rather have a Republican. So, and the person running wasn't a Democrat. So it was, they didn't want a constitutional sheriff. They wanted a Republican. And that's what they had. So that is an issue that, and I know if we're going to do anything, it has to be a grassroots level. And I'm not saying that's wrong. But I'm going to tell you, if you're going to work at the grassroots level, you have to put liberty and freedom before political party, because parties aren't concerned with liberty and freedom, neither one of them. So that is something you have to do if you vote, if you work local. And if you were expecting me to be a politician for plus or for one side or the other, because I cuss Democrats doesn't mean I'm a Republican, and if I cuss Republicans doesn't mean I'm a Democrat, because I don't like either one of them. So that is the issue, and I can show you people who are destroying the Constitution on both sides of the political aisle and have been for my entire lifetime. So we need to at least get people. The governor of South Dakota has said, hey, now we're going to go by the Constitution. I will make some recommendations. And you've had one sheriff there in Colorado that I know of that's done the exact same thing, Terry. He said, look, here are the recommendations, wear a mask, stay quarantined, blah, 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 blah. But you are an adult. You have a right to make your own decision, so get it done. And that's what we need. We need the people to say, okay, here's what is recommended. But see, that's where you that's where the difference between being a citizen, or if you, and I know that word can be played with, but whether you are a citizen or whether you're a slave, you can do what you want to, then you are a citizen under your state constitution. And most of your state constitutions say that at any time the people want to, they can either alter or abolish their government. Now, how many of you knew that? That was in the Declaration of Independence. I know in Arkansas it's Article 2, Section 1 of the Arkansas Constitution. It says very simply that any time that the government exceeds its authority, it's time for the citizens to stand up and either alter or abolish it. And we're not doing that either. People are believing somehow, people want somebody to tell them what to do. I've never figured that one out. I mean, I can make plenty of mistakes on my own. I already have. But the thing of it is I did them. They're my, I own them. They're mine. And so you step forward and you take, you don't wait for the government to rescue you or to pull you out of something. And I was just reading before, you know, before we leave about talking about today's program, I was reading some of the stipulations that the federal government is putting on companies who are taking these stimulus loans. They are implementing Marxism on these companies. And if the federal government's not going to own the company, it's going to dictate to the company who they can hire, who they can't hire, and how many of a particular race they have to have, or how many of a particular gender, whatever they choose their gender to be. So for their own rights. And they're believing because the government says something that it must be gospel. That's called civic religion. And I think there's a Bible verse that deals with that, Matthew 6:24. How many masters can you have in your life? And I had someone tell me a couple of days ago on another radio show that, well, you know, when I brought up something that I thought was coming down the road in the future, and we can talk about that, you know, on another program, Terry, but I've said something, somebody said, well, that will never happen here. And I said, well, 3 months ago you would have told me that the police would never arrest a preacher for preaching in a church too, wouldn't you? So don't tell me it won't happen here. Because so many things have happened here since the 1st of March or the end of February, people would have said, I guarantee you back then it'll never happen here. So I'll jump off my soapbox. You go ahead, Jerry.
Well, I think we need to give people a homework assignment between now and next week, and my homework assignment for the people is to go read the Declaration of Independence. And I'll just close out here with a brief excerpt from it. Prudence indeed will dictate change for light and transient causes, that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer whilst evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. If you've got a governor that's shutting down your state right now, he is abusing you, and he is a despot, or her, and it's time we let them know that we're going to throw off anybody who's going to destroy our economy, which in turn destroys our freedom, who is in fact stepping on our unalienable rights right now, that we're not going to take it. So that's all I've got, Mike. And I think it's time for us to sign off. Until next week, we'll pick up where we left off in Mike's history lesson about us being swindled from the beginning regarding the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 that yielded the current Constitution. Any closing quick comment, Mike?
No, that was very good, Terry. Just my comment is that I wanted to give a broad overview tonight, and that with our next program, I'll start getting specific on this to give you specific things to look at, specific letters to read, and et cetera.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight, and hope you'll listen in and refer us to other listeners and catch our podcast. We'll be back next Thursday night at 6 o'clock Mountain Time, 7 o'clock Central, with Handling the Truth. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
In a no-win situation, you're sold out to the